lot of people turn to stoicism like I did in the middle of a crisis. It's a little bit like somebody's running after you with a knife and you want to take lessons in martial arts right there. It's like, well, it's a little late.
What kind of symptoms do you think people are experiencing in their life in order for them to turn to stoicism?
If it turns out that there is nothing you can do about an event or how a person behaves or something like that, you might as well endure it. I mean, what else are you going to do? It's useful no matter what, in good times and bad times. And in fact, it would be much better to start it in good times. Successful, empirically based type of psychotherapy out there, it's directly based on stoicism.
People think about stoicism without knowing much about it. They think it's about pressing emotions.
I can say, I hear you, because I was there. By far the most important thing is...
Massimo Piglucci, welcome to the podcast.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
It's amazing to have you here. So we kick off the same way every single time. So I'm going to ask you a big open question. Who are you and what problem does Stoicism solve?
Who am I? That's a good question, because the Oracle at Delphi says that we should know ourselves. So, you know, it's a good way to start, to get started. I don't know. As a background, I am an evolutionary biologist. I started out my first academic career in that area. I was interested in gene-environment interactions, or nature-nurture kind of issues. And then I had a midlife crisis, both professionally and personally, and so I pivoted to philosophy, in particular philosophy of science. I'm interested in the distinction between science and pseudoscience. But in the process of dealing with that midlife crisis, I was looking at some kind of resources, something that could help me navigate the problems and sort of reframe the way I was looking at things, reprioritizing, and that's when I discovered Stoicism. So the answer to the second question is, Stoicism helps you framing things in a way that makes sense, in a way that helps you prioritize what you want to do in life and prompts you to ask why you want to do certain things. But broadly speaking, Stoicism is one of a number of philosophies of life, the goal of which is to make you a better human being, or the Stoics would say, the best human being you can be.
I like that. So, and I don't want to go too personal, so take this kind of where you want, Massimo, but in terms of people listening to this, you said a midlife crisis, and I know that a lot of people that are going through things find Stoicism, turn to Stoicism. What kind of symptoms do you think people are experiencing in their life in order for Stoicism to maybe find them or for them to turn to Stoicism?
So a lot of people turn to Stoicism like I did in the middle of a crisis, in the middle of you know, something is happening, you feel like you don't have the resources to deal with whatever it is happening. And I'll tell you actually a little bit more detail about my specific experience, because it may be useful in general, sort of as an example of the kind of things we're talking about. But I do think that's a mistake, actually. Turning to Stoicism in the middle of a crisis, it's a little bit like somebody's running after you with a knife and you want to take lessons in martial arts right there. It's like, well, it's a little late, you know. You should have started doing that a little earlier. Yes, you can still get some pointers and maybe you're going to survive the attack, but it would be better to be preemptive about these kind of things. So I actually think that Stoicism is just like other philosophies of life, such as, let's say, Buddhism, for instance. It's useful no matter what, in good times and bad times. And in fact, it would be much better to start it in good times, so that when and if the bad times come, you're kind of ready. In my case, what was happening was that, first of all, as I said, was a professional issue. I got to the point where in my career where I felt I reached a plateau and I could have kept coasting for the rest of my life, basically, but that was not satisfactory. I needed something else. And so that kind of, since I always thought of myself as a scientist, not a philosopher, that was kind of an interesting situation to find yourself in. So there was that. That very same year, just by coincidence, I was hit with a divorce that I was not expecting, sort of kind of out of the blue. I thought things were going fine, and turns out they were not. And also my father died. That also was not exactly unexpected. My father had been suffering from multiple types of cancer for a while. But nevertheless, when it did happen, it really hit hard. And these kind of things happen in the span of a few months. And now any psychologist will tell you that one of those things is stressful enough. If three or four of them happen at the same time, that's going to take a toll. Now, what my initial reaction was, okay, well, I do have actually a framework, I thought, because when I left the Catholic Church, I grew up in Italy, so naturally I was by default a Catholic. But I left the church when I was a teenager. And ever since, I consider myself a secular humanist. It's a general broad philosophy that has to do with human rights and using reason and that sort of stuff. It's like, well, that sounds good. So I thought I had the resources. And I turned to secular humanism and I said, okay, let's see what it can do for me here. And it turns out, not much. Because it's one thing to be in favor of, you know, general ideas like human rights, the science is a good thing and all that sort of stuff. Great. But how is that going to help me dealing with a divorce and my father dying or changing a career? So I started looking more or less systematically. I kind of embarked in a search for a new philosophy of life. I actually started out with Buddhism because many of my friends were telling me, you know, that you might want to look into that in that direction. And Buddhism was very interesting. It has lots of interesting and useful things to do, to say. It does have actual tools, practical tools that are helpful for people, different kinds of meditations, for instance, but also the philosophical basis, the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path to Enlightenment. And yet it just did not speak my language. It didn't resonate. I couldn't get past some of the metaphysics, which as a scientist, I thought didn't really go well with my worldview. So I moved on, and eventually, fairly quickly, I arrived to the Greco-Roman philosophies. That's a group of philosophies that evolved over a span of several hundred years, almost a millennium, in the Mediterranean world. They're all kind of related to each other, and the fundamental thing that unifies them is that they're all types of virtue ethics. That is, they are an approach to life that is based on character. Character development and improvement or your own character and way of looking at things. So I started looking at some of those philosophies. Whenever you talk about virtue ethics, usually that's Aristotle. So I started with Aristotle. And Aristotle was very interesting, but not very practical. Then I moved to Epicurus. You know, the sex, drugs, and rock and roll of philosophy, which it turns out actually not, that's really a misunderstanding of Epicureanism. Epicurus has a lot of interesting and practical things to say, but one of the things that he recommends is that in order to have a tranquil and serene life, you really should get as far as possible away from any kind of social or political involvement, because those are troublesome. They create trouble. And he was right, but I cannot see a meaningful life, for me at least, without social political involvement. So I was in the middle of this process, and one day on what at the time was called Twitter, I saw this thing that said, help us celebrate Stoic Week. And I thought, the hell is Stoic Week, and why would anybody want to celebrate the Stoics? Because I thought of the Stoics as Mr. Spock from Star Trek, right? So people going around with a stiff upper lip and suppressing emotions. Don't get me wrong. Spock is my favorite character in Star Trek, but I wouldn't want to be one. It's not the way I was kind of envisioning my life. But it turns out that then I remember, it's like, wait a minute, but the Stoics, that means Marcus Aurelius. I read his Meditations when I was in college. I found it an interesting book. The Stoics also means Seneca. I translated some of these letters when I was in high school from Latin. So I said, but I never actually put them together. I never thought that they were talking about the same thing. So I thought, maybe I should take a look at this stuff. And here we are now, a number of, you know, more than a decade later. I'm still doing it and talking about it.
Wow. So many different places we could take that. Thank you for being so open as well about your journey there. I think one of the things that'd be interesting to get your perspective on, because you've been through this journey and probably had this bias beforehand, but sometimes when people think about Stoicism without knowing much about it, they think it's about suppressing emotions.
Right.
So what do you say to those people who come to that conclusion?
Yeah, I can say I hear you because I was there. So, you know, there are two major misconceptions about Stoicism. One, it's about the suppressing of emotions. And the other one is, which is related, which is about sporting a stiff upper lip, the classic stiff upper lip. Now, in other words, not reacting, you know, taking it in without actually, you know, externalizing your reactions. Just like with many other stereotypes, there is a grain of truth there. And I think it's important to understand where that comes from, because the best way to combat a stereotype is to acknowledge that it comes from a place and then say, yeah, but here's why it's mistaken, right? So let's start with the stiff upper lip because it's easier. That comes out of the fact that in Stoicism, endurance is in fact a virtue. If it turns out that there is nothing you can do about an event or how a person behaves or something like that, you might as well endure it. I mean, what else are you going to do? You don't have a lot of options. Marcus Aurelius says, if you disagree with somebody, teach them, try to talk to them, trying to be reasonable with them. But if they insist, endure. You know, patience is a virtue, and it's like, what are you going to do? You know, you don't have a lot of other options. So endurance is in fact something the Stoics do cultivate, and it's easy to mistake endurance for stiff upper lip. But Stoics do disagree with other people and let other people know that they disagree. They just try to do it reasonably, rationally, without getting, you know, upset and that sort of stuff. So it's an issue of, on the one hand, accepting what is not up to you, and on the other hand, trying to do whatever it is that actually you can do. So it's not a passive philosophy. It's not a question of just taking it. It's not a question of behaving like a doormat where other people walk all over you. It's just an issue of rationally understanding that there are certain situations where there is not much else you can do, and so you might as well accept it. So that's the stiff upper lip. The suppression of emotion, it's a little bit more complicated, but it's also more interesting. The Stoics had that sophisticated theory of emotions, sophisticated psychology of emotions, which turned out to be actually very much in line with modern cognitive behavioral therapy. In fact, modern cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT, which is the most successful empirically based type of psychotherapy out there, it's directly based on Stoicism. It started out in the 1960s, early 60s, with people like Aaron Beck and others here in New York, as a matter of fact. And they explicitly acknowledged the origin of CBT in Stoicism. They said these ideas do come from Marcus Aurelius, Epictetus, and other people. So there is some empirical basis to this thing. But the basic... The fundamental notion that the Stoics had is that emotions can be divided into healthy and unhealthy. Healthy emotions ought to be mindfully cultivated. Those are the good stuff in life. And unhealthy emotions ought to be, as much as possible, dealt with and sort of trying to talk to them so that you diffuse them. The basic idea is that emotions have a cognitive component. That is, when you say, for instance, if you get angry, anger is, for the Stoics, one of the unhealthy emotions because it gets in the way of your acting reasonably and pro-socially, which is the goal of Stoicism. Stoic philosophy is about acting reasonably and pro-socially, meaning cooperatively with other people, you know, realizing that we are in together on this thing and that we better work with each other. So any emotional reaction that gets in the way of that makes you act irrationally or not socially, antisocially, then it's unhealthy and you need to deal with it. Now, if you get angry at something, right, and so you start raising the tone of your voice and start, you know, changing your facial appearance, you know, your muscles, tighten, all that sort of stuff. If I stop you at some point, I say, well, why were you angry? What was going on there, right? In the moment, you might not be able to actually process it. It's never a good idea to ask a reasonable question to somebody who's in the middle of the fit of anger. But later on, right, so I see you in the evening and we have a drink and say, you know, what was going on? You will be able to tell me a story. You'll be able to say, well, you know, that jerk of my boss at work, he just took it on me, even though it was his mistake, blah, blah, blah. In other words, you have a story that actually, unbeknownst to you probably, at the time fed the anger, right? So your boss was saying something harsh to you, and you started subconsciously or not telling yourself a story and say, well, it's bad to be berated by my boss, it's bad that he's angry at me, he's bad, etc. I need to react, right? And that's why you get angry. So the Stoics maintain that, well, you can counteract that story. You can tell yourself a different story. You can say, no, there is nothing bad about my boss doing that. He's just doing the boss. Boss kind of thing. I have an option of reacting differently. I can do things differently. It's not mandatory that I actually react in that way. It may seem inevitable, obvious, et cetera, but there is nothing inevitable or obvious about my reaction, and so I can be prepared to react differently. That is where the suppression of emotion stereotype comes from. It's not a question of suppressing emotions, which, by the way, it's not possible. It's just not a thing, right? And the emotions are there, whether you want them or not. You cannot suppress them. It's a question of analyzing and literally talking to your emotions. Epictetus, one of the second century Stoics, actually literally says, you need to look at what he calls your impression, which is your first judgment about things, and slow down and say, wait a minute, you're not what you look like. I need to actually understand what's going on here and calm down and try to find a better way of doing things, if it makes sense.
It makes perfect sense. I've actually done things the opposite way to you. So I've started with Stoicism and I've ended up recently looking into Zen Buddhism. And Zen
whatever Buddhism, works, man.
Zen Buddhism, though, seems to almost be this kind of remix of Stoicism in some ways of the certain ideas. And one of the things that it keeps talking about is this idea of behind the emotion is this observer who sees the emotion flow. Do you think Stoicism is kind of also leading us to that as well, of there are emotions there, but how do I activate the observer?
In a sense, yes, that's right. There is the observer, what the Buddhists call the observer, for the Stoics is this little thing that we have in the middle of our brain, and it's called your prohairesis in Greek. It's basically your faculty of will. According to Epictetus, that's really who you are. You are not your limbs, you're not your eyes, you're not your anything else. You are your prohairesis. You are your faculty of decision, which modern neuroscience locates actually in the prefrontal cortex. That's where our so-called executive function resides. This is the area of the brain that is in charge of reason, rational decision-making, all that sort of stuff. And interestingly, and the Stoics would not have been surprised by this, the prefrontal cortex is deeply interconnected by literally billions of connections and millions of neural fibers with the amygdala, which is where the emotional responses come out, right? So again, when you get angry, the first thing that happens is your physiological reaction, right? You feel getting angry. You feel yourself getting angry. That's because your amygdala is beginning to flood your brain with hormones, and those hormones are telling you there is something wrong here. I need to react, especially adrenaline. It's the big one. Then you become aware and your prefrontal cortex gets engaged and starts making up stories about, okay, what's going on here? Why am I getting upset, et cetera, et cetera. But going back to Buddhism, many people have pointed out that despite the major differences between Stoicism and Buddhism in terms of metaphysics, their ethics is very similar. Buddhism approaches things differently. The techniques are different. You know, the kinds of meditations you find in Buddhism are very different from the kind of meditations you find in Stoicism. But the basic story about what's going on, it's very similar. The basic story, you know, what the Buddhists would tell you is that the root of suffering is our attachment. It's our rapacious ego, as they sometimes put it. We're too attached to things, to people, to all sorts of stuff, and that's what causes suffering, both our own suffering and the suffering of others. And therefore, the answer there is to detach yourself to some extent, or to the extent that is possible, from these things. Well, Epictetus would certainly agree. He would say, you know, you guys are too much into what the Stoics call externals, things like wealth and reputation and, you know, number of likes on Twitter or something like that, right? And those things are not really important. They certainly have value, The Stoics don't go as far as saying that those things are entirely unimportant, but they are not really the most important thing in your life. The most important thing in your life is your ability to reason through your problems and to act in a way that is social toward other human beings. Those are the crucial things. Everything else is secondary. And mistaking that, making a mistake in priorities, thinking that things like wealth and reputation and fame and all that sort of stuff are actually the most important things, that's what creates a lot of trouble, according to the Stoics.
I feel like we've had probably similar paths. So I stumbled into Buddhism. I spent some time in a Buddhist monastery. When I say time, I don't mean 10 years. I mean 3 nights. but I did a lot of reading while I was there and learning. And the attachment thing is a real, real interesting one, because when I sat with some of the monks, they were saying that when new monks come, typically they'll find an attachment to the bowl or the robes that they wear. And it was a case of like, this attachment is within us. So a lot of people that I speak to, and we run a sales company, and we say like, do you know what I mean? The root of all evil is attachment. So how do you actually remove that? What the conversations that you can have with yourself? What advice would you give to people that are trying to remove the attachment in life?
That's a very good question. There are a number of ways to answer it, but my favorite actually comes from an author who is not technically a Stoic, although it was kind of Stoic adjacent or Stoic curious. And that's Marcus Tullius Cicero, who was arguably the most important of the Roman philosophers. So Cicero occasionally wrote critically about Stoicism, but most of the times he was actually very interested in and very favorable to Stoic ethics especially. And the way he put it at some point in one of his books is he invites his readers to do a thought experiment, to engage in a thought experiment. He says, look, imagine that all of a sudden one of the gods comes down and grants you everything you want. All of the material possessions, great place where to live, you know, health, wealth, everything. But on one condition, you will only be able to enjoy it in a solitary confinement on a deserted island. Would you accept it? And of course the answer is no, because we want to share those. You know, the whole point is to show other people and share other people, right? So his point is, that tells you that what you think is so important, it's actually secondary. The important thing is relationships with other people, right? And again, it's not that the other stuff doesn't have value. Of course, other things, Seneca puts it in an interesting fashion. At some point, somebody must have asked him a similar question. And so in one of his letters to his friend Lucilius, Seneca says, you know, I'm not stupid. I prefer to be healthy rather than sick. I prefer to be wealthy rather than poor. I prefer to be educated rather than ignorant, and so on and so forth, right? And it's like, you know, this isn't even a question. But all of those things are secondary, because they are all means to an end. And the end is happiness, what the ancient Greco-Romans called eudaimonia, the life worth living. And what is happiness? Well, it turns out that both the ancient Greco-Romans and modern research in psychology, in the psychology of happiness, which is a thing, it's a subdiscipline, come up with the same answer. It's mostly about relationships with other people. If you look at these ongoing study, longitudinal study that Harvard University has been doing for a while now, for decades, they've been following a number of families and their descendants at this point. And every few years they check with them and they, you know, how they're doing and what makes them happy or unhappy, what kind of life events are taking place, et cetera, et cetera. And they just published a book summarizing some of the results like last year. You can read the whole book, but I can give you the punchline. By far the most important thing is friendships and other relationships. That's it. When people get to the end of their lives and they look back, they are not going to make a big deal out of, well, did I make enough money? Did I have enough Twitter followers or something like that? What they're making a big deal is, did I spend enough time with my children, with my partner, with my friends, et cetera, et cetera. That's what it is about. And the Stoics got that early on, and they kind of rearranged their entire lives around that insight. That is, what's important is we're social animals. So what is important is our relationships with other people. Everything else, it's good if it's there. But a life, but one can have also a good life, meaning a life with characterized by meaningful human relations, even if somebody is sick, poor, ignorant, et cetera, et cetera, right? So even if everything else goes badly, yeah, you're not going to have a particularly pleasant life. That's true. But it might still be meaningful. And one of the examples that I have is my own grandfather. So I was, when I grew up, I was essentially adopted by my grandparents because my parents divorced and neither one of them had the ability or will to raise my brother and I. And so my grandparents picked up the slack. And in fact, what I refer to as my grandfather, we were not even related by blood. He was my grandmother's partner and later husband. He absolutely embraced the role. He really became by far the most important figure in my childhood. He was not particularly educated. He was not wealthy, for sure. He was reasonably healthy, but, you know, nothing to brag about. He really did not have any of those externals or external goods that most people think make for a good life. And yet, he was one of the best people I've ever met in my life. I mean, he was just always gentle and calm and helpful and just present, right? And so we all have incredibly good memories of him because of that. I don't think that we would have had any better memories had he been also rich or famous or anything like that.
You remember the way that people make you feel. I was listening to something a little while ago with you. I can't remember, maybe 3 or 4 months ago. And I might have got this completely wrong, so we might have to re-edit this. And you say, actually, that's not true, Jack.
Let's give it a try.
Yeah. But what I was listening to, it felt like your philosophy was you take stoicism, but you also kind of like dual wield it with skepticism.
Yeah. Is that correct? No, that's correct. Yeah, that is correct.
Okay. Right guy. Here we go.
So here's the problem, right? So that's why with a couple of friends of mine, Greg Lopez and Meredith Kunz, we just wrote this book that it's behind me, Beyond Stoicism. It's called literally Beyond Stoicism, right? Which is a exploration of a number of Greco-Roman philosophies, including Stoicism, but not only. So here's the thing. The Stoic philosophy is a very internally coherent, incredibly well-developed system of thought, just like Buddhism is, just like Christianity. By the way, I think of religions as just another type of philosophy of life. You know, we have a bit of a different metaphysics, but nevertheless, they're still philosophies of life. All of these systems have been honed by hundreds or thousands of thinkers over thousands of years. And so they are highly coherent. They will have, if you go to a Buddhist or a Christian or a Stoic and ask a question, they will have an answer. And that answer will come out organically out of their system. The problem, however, is that, you know, these are human systems, and therefore none of them is perfect, whatever perfection actually even means in this particular context. There will be issues. There will be problems. For instance, in the case of Stoicism, the ancient Stoics believed that the universe itself is a living organism endowed with reason, what they call the logos. Okay, so they were essential, and they called that God. In essence, we would say today they were pantheists. They thought that God was the universe itself. Right? Great. If that's true, then it follows. Certain things follows within Stoicism, including a notion of providence. Everything that happens is literally for the good of the universe, right? And we are bits and pieces of that universe. So everything we do, even the bad stuff, even when we get sick, for instance, it's for the good of the universe. Well, if I believe that, I would be very happy. But I'm a scientist. I don't think the universe is a living organism, right? I'm a biologist. I don't see the universe as a living organism. It just does not have any of the characteristics of a living organism. Therefore, I have to reject that part of Stoicism. If I do that, then I cannot help myself logically, coherently, to the Stoic notion of providence. And so I'm left with having to reinvent, to modify the system to some extent. I still think it mostly works because it's mostly based on good insights on the nature of things and in particular on the nature of humanity, of human beings, human psychology. So I still think it works, but I am perfectly within my right as a skeptic to say, you know what, that part doesn't work. I'm going to do away with it and I'm going to replace it. That's exactly, incidentally, the attitude that was adopted by Cicero, the philosopher, the Roman philosopher that I mentioned a few minutes ago, who in fact considered himself a skeptic. Right, so he was a member of the Skeptic Academy, which was a skeptical phase of Plato's Academy. And the skeptics believed that human beings usually or maybe ever never get to truth with a capital T or knowledge with a capital K. Why? Well, because we arrive at our tentative truths by two means, either by our senses, we see things, we hear things, etc., or by our reason, by our ability to reason about things. But we also know that both our senses and our reasoning ability are fallacious. We can make mistakes, and we'll never know when we're making a mistake until perhaps later on somebody else corrects it. So at any particular moment, you can never be sure that you have the truth with a capital T. It may always be the case that sometime down the road, somebody says, you know what, that was wrong. Here's why. If that's the case, and I believe it is the case, then you have to adopt an attitude that modern philosophers call fallibilism. You have to assume that your own conclusions are fallible. They may be wrong. And therefore, you don't want to be too attached to those conclusions. Right. If you start treating Stoicism as a religion, and you never question Marcus Aurelius or Epictetus or Seneca because you know that's what they said and that's what I'm going to believe, you're asking for trouble, because one of these days it may be that a new scientific discovery or a new discovery in psychology shows that something that the Stoics thought was correct, it's actually not true, and now what are you going to do? Now you have to start rationalize things, or you get into a serious crisis because you have to abandon the whole thing. So instead of doing that, Cicero and myself have adopted this notion that, yeah, sure, broadly speaking, I'm a Stoic, but with a skeptic reserve clause. That is, I don't actually believe 100% anything. There are beliefs comes in degrees. There are some things that you don't really have a lot of confidence in. Like, for instance, if you were to ask me, is the number of stars in the night sky in New York odd or even? I'm going to say odd, but I don't have a lot of confidence in that answer. It's like, yeah, it's 50-50, really. I don't really know. But if you ask me, are, generally speaking, vaccines safe to use in human beings to fight, prevent diseases, I'd say, yeah, I'm pretty confident about that. 100%? No. 90, 95, maybe 99, but not 100, because I could be wrong. And I think that's a wonderful attitude. And I take that from Cicero, which is probably no surprise. I just finished writing a book on Cicero that comes out next year, because he has such a major influence on me.
Based on that then, so the skepticism versus stoicism debate, do you think Socrates would have been a skeptic or a stoic?
Yeah, no, he was definitely, so that's interesting that you bring up Socrates, because the Stoics literally thought of themselves as Socratics, as followers of Socrates. They called themselves Socratics, right? So did other schools, of course. The Platonists did the same, the Aristotelians actually also did the same. But the Stoics were very specific, very explicit. They said, yeah, we're just following Socrates here. The skeptics, the academic skeptics, people like Cicero, also thought they were following Socrates. And what was happening there is that they were following two different aspects of the Socratic teachings, right? So Socrates, on the one hand, is very much into virtue, character building, being reasonable and pro-social. If you read the Socratic dialogues, both the ones written by Plato and the ones written by Xenophon, you will see that very clearly comes across. So the Stoics were right in saying that they were Socratics in the sense that they emphasized behaving pro-socially and reasonably. That's what Socrates was trying to do. But at the same time, you read the same dialogues, and it's also very obvious that Socrates is a skeptic. He claims no knowledge, right? The reason why the oracle at Delphi at one point said that Socrates was the wisest man in Greece is because Socrates was the only one that admitted that he didn't know crap, right? And if you actually look at what how Socrates interacts with his friends and with his with people that just listen to him, he doesn't lecture. He doesn't say, here's the truth, here's what, you know, he's not Jesus in a sense, right? Jesus really gives you the sermons, he gives you the truth. But Socrates says, okay, let's try to figure out what is the problem here? Oh, we want to know about the nature of courage. All right, let's talk about it. What do you think courage is, right? And then he lets people to sort of articulate their own vision. And then a little later on, he starts asking questions. And then a little later on, he says, wait a minute, but what you just said now, it sort of seems to be in tension with what you said 10 minutes ago. Don't you think there is an issue there? And the other guy says, oh yeah, you're right, Socrates, damn it. So let's start over, right? Most of the Socratic dialogues end in what the Greeks called aporia, which literally means confusion. So in other words, you don't get an answer, right? Even though sometimes it's pretty clear that Socrates does have some answer in mind and he prefers one version of, you know, one account to another, you're really never sure. You get to the end of the dialogue and say, okay, so what? Now I don't know what courage is. We've talked about it for an hour and I don't know anything about it. Not true. You have figured out a lot of things that are not correct about courage. You have discarded a lot of ideas that you might have had and they turned out to be incorrect. So you do know something. You know by elimination. You get rid of the stuff that doesn't work, and hopefully what remains is increasingly closer to the truth. This is a stunningly modern idea. In the 20th century, one of the most famous philosophers of science, Karl Popper, said that that's exactly how science proceeds. Science doesn't proceed by proving theories. That's impossible because a new experiment can always show something different down the line. How science produces is by eliminating bad ideas. It's like carving things out. It's like Michelangelo said how he was sculpting. He said the sculpture is already in the marble block. I'm just taking away marble. Right. That's a nice way to put it. I don't believe that that's what Michelangelo was saying, but it's a nice metaphor. Right. So this notion that you get the beauty of, and you get truth by eliminating the stuff that surrounds it that doesn't work.
I love that. There's another thing that seems to be at odds as well. So I was always raised, especially during school, it's all about a positive mental attitude, right? And then right. When you get into Stoicism, often what they're talking about is, let's imagine the worst. So that when you get there, you're comfortable with the worst scenarios. That always says the total opposite of a positive mental attitude. So
that's right.
Coming at it from a science perspective, what do you think is the truth out of those two perspectives?
Yeah, good question. So there is actually pretty good evidence at this point that even from so-called positive psychology, that trying to force yourself into an optimistic sort of outlook doesn't work because life is inevitably going to disappoint you. you're going to be inevitably, make wrong decisions because you're being optimistic about outcomes and stuff like that. At the same time, psychology also very clearly shows that a pessimistic attitude is not good because it leads to depression and leads to all sorts of, you know, negative outcomes. But the Stoics were trying to be realists. They would not put it in terms of either optimism or pessimism. They would just say, look, we're trying to figure out how the world actually is, and we're trying to figure out the best way to live in that world. Now, there are lots of good things about life, if you're lucky, and you should definitely enjoy them. Right? At some point, Seneca says, pleasure is in agreement with nature, meaning that it's natural for human beings to seek pleasure. And pain, he says, is in disagreement with nature, meaning that we tend to avoid pain. So great, go ahead and do that. And if there is something, there's some attitude that helps you navigate life that way, by all means. But at the same time, remember, things will go wrong at some point. The obvious example is you will lose loved ones. At some point, some important people in your life are going to die. And then eventually, of course, you're going to die. So just be ready. No, don't push it out of your mind like we tend to do in modern Western culture. Although the modern Western attitude toward death, it's actually unusual historically and culturally. Most other cultures throughout history have actually faced death and been in touch with death constantly. We are the ones that put the old people in a different place, you know, and we don't want to see them. We put the people that are dying in a different place, and we don't want to go and have anything to do with it. It's not kosher to talk about death or sickness in polite conversation and that sort of stuff. The Stoics would say, nonsense, that's just a part of life, just like anything else. And so in the same way in which you want to be prepared to enjoy the good things, you do need to be prepared to withstand the bad things. And so one of the standard exercises in Stoicism is called the premeditatio malorum, which is Latin for, loosely translated, think ahead about bad crap happening. And it's the idea is, you want to foresee possible negative outcomes of things from minor things, like, let's say, a job interview. You know, you want to imagine that you're not getting the job because that's a possibility. It's a real possibility. To the big ones, like imagining your own death, for instance, right? Now, there's one major caveat, however, about this. It's crucial how you actually do it. If you do it by getting emotionally distraught about it and start getting anxious about it, that's not the way to do it. Stop right there. If you engage in a premeditatio malorum and you feel anxiety rising, don't do it. Stop. Modern cognitive behavioral therapy will say, tell you the same thing. If that's what you're getting, then stop and rethink about it. Maybe try later with something less challenging. Don't start with your own death. Start with maybe a mug that it's going to break or something like that, right? That's easier to deal with. The way you're supposed to do it is analytically. That is, you want to describe to yourself the event as if you were talking to a friend and try to console him about that thing, right? So it's not about you. It's about helping somebody else. And it's not about emotional reactions, it's about describing it in very clear and sort of neutral terms. There's a wonderful example of this in Marcus Aurelius' Meditations. So at one point, he writes down, he says, remember that wonderful meal that you just had tonight was just a dead fish. And remember that, you know, that wonderful wine that you drank, it's just fermented grape juice. And remember that sex is just a friction of parts and an explosion of mucus. Now, you read that and you say, what the hell is wrong with this guy, right? clearly not somebody who is enjoying the pleasures of life. But in fact, it's quite the opposite. We know that Marcus Aurelius was too much into drinking, eating gourmet food and having sex. I mean, after all, he had 14 children, right? So what he's trying to do there is to distance himself, to tell himself, it's like, you know, slow down. Yes, these things are pleasurable, but don't think that they're that important. They are part of an enjoyable life, but they're not so crucial. And one way to remind yourself that they're not so crucial is to redescribe them to yourself in a way that doesn't make them very appealing.
I have absolutely loved this conversation. I'm obsessed with death, as Zach knows, and I talk about memento mori and all those beautiful things. And I thought the analytical reframe and the perspective change, that was amazing. Brilliant. For anybody that's getting into Stoicism or they're thinking about putting their foot into the water, what's one piece of advice you would give them before they kind of walk into the sea?
Oh, that's another very good question. There are so many things, but one thing is to be careful, because there is a lot of literature now out there on Stoicism, which was not the case just even 10 years ago. When my first book, which I think in the UK it's entitled Live Like a Stoic, came out, that was one of the very few. There was not another two or three, maybe, perhaps. Now there are hundreds of things. And of course, there's plenty of podcasts and blogs and newsletters and all that sort of stuff. Need to be careful, however, because a lot of what's out there, it's not really about stoicism per se, not the philosophy. It's about life hacks. And life hacks are fine. There's not a problem if they are used correctly. But they're not the philosophy. There's a major difference. For instance, if we're talking about Buddhism as an analogy, just because you meditate, that doesn't make you a Buddhist, right? In fact, a lot of Buddhists don't actually meditate at all. Meditations are techniques that are meant to be helpful for the practice of Buddhism, but they're not necessary for that practice. And definitely meditating doesn't make you a Buddhist. What makes you a Buddhist is the acceptance of the Four Noble Truths or the pursuit of the Eightfold Path to Enlightenment. That is what makes you a Buddhist, regardless of whether you actually meditate or not. It's the same thing with Stoicism. Stoicism is not about necessarily the premeditatio malorum or taking a cold shower or you know things of that sort. Those are techniques that are meant to help with specific issues, and they're certainly helpful. There is very good empirical evidence that they're helpful. But don't confuse them with the philosophy. The philosophy is about becoming a better human being, which the Stoics specifically defined as learning to think as reasonably, as rationally as possible, and learning to be as much of a cosmopolitan as possible, as much as useful to other human beings as possible. That is what Stoicism is about. So I would be simply careful about what kind of books to pick up. There's a corollary to this. Sometimes I hear people who say, oh, I don't need modern Stoic authors. I'm just going to go straight to the source. You know, I'm just going to read Epictetus or Marcus Aurelius, etc. I wouldn't do it. Now, people could accuse me of having a bone into this thing because I write books about Stoicism. Fine, don't buy my books. Buy somebody else's books. It's okay. But here's the problem. The ancient books are actually deceptive to some extent because modern translations are so good and the ancient authors were actually themselves fairly clear in what they were writing, that you may get the impression that you actually get what they're saying, but you might not. Not unless you get one of those editions with lots of footnotes with somebody actually explaining you what is going on. For instance, a very, very common mistake is for people, the first thing they do with Stoicism is to pick up the Enchiridion, Epictetus' manual. And the reason for that is because it's short. Right? It's only 53 paragraphs. It's just a few pages. You can read the whole thing in an afternoon. Or less. Right. The problem is the Enchiridion was meant as a recap for advanced students of Stoicism, right? So if that's the first thing you're going to read, you're going to run into all sorts of stuff. What the hell is he talking about? Why is he saying this? And then you're likely to put it down and say, no, this is a bunch of crap that I don't need. And that would be a mistake, I think. It would be a missed opportunity.
Some powerful advice there. Massimo, thank you for joining us today. I've been looking forward to this and you've delivered. If people want to buy your books, check you out, get in contact with you, where should they go? What should they do? How do we send people flooding your way?
Well, first of all, it was a pleasure having this conversation. It's always a lot of fun to have intelligent conversations. So my books are available anywhere you buy books, online or in person. In terms of getting in touch with me and following my work, you can go to my Substack, which is called The Philosophy Garden, or you can find everything else, pretty much everything I do, at massimopilucci.org.
Lovely. Thank you so much for joining us today.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.